So correct, Ife Dancy, you can't go wrong with Sam Cooke from his CD, Keep Moving On. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio, WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. I'm Michael G. Haskins, the station's chief announcer and your host and radio guide, weekday afternoons. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be the Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, trying to help you lead a more positively minded life. But right now at 12 noon, coming up next, The Gary Null Show.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you. Today, we're going to take a really in-depth look in our environmental segment of our program on global warming and the new math. I will be sharing insights and information with you that have not yet been reported in any of the mainstream media. In fact, mostly alternative media. It will be based upon research by Bill McKibben in an extensive article in Rolling Stone. Then a commentary that I feel is long overdue when we're a nation now that's obsessed with every form of extreme athletic competition. And his intake on this, his input on this, I think, is revealing. So we'll hear what he has to say on the perversion of scholarship in the publication's Truth Dig. Also, the latest on health and healing, my guest in the second part of our program today, a newsmaker interview with Dr. Seth Farber, the failure of psychiatry and re-envisioning what it means to be mad. And he is a well-known social critic, a dissident psychotherapist, psychologist, and he has some unique gifts to share on this. Let's begin with the latest on health and healing, as we do each day. This is from Ethan Huff, and it says, the White House chef says future food to be made from chemicals, not real ingredients, and I'll quote this. Every 2 years, a consortium of Europe's most active minds converges on a group at the Euroscience Open Forum to discuss the latest advancements in scientific research and innovation. But this year's meeting, which was held in Dublin, Ireland, featured a disturbing workshop held by the White House executive pastry chef, Bill Yassas, who explained and demonstrated to audience members how the food of the future will not actually contain any real food, but rather various combinations of laboratory-created chemicals that mimic food. As reported on 6-1 News, which is a feature of the Irish television, the chef and several other food experts showed a live audience how to create a various group of foams, gels, solids, and other food-like textured substances out of chemicals that, when combined, well, kind of resembled a lemon souffle or chocolate pudding. These food scientists then shared samples of these laboratory creations with the audience members, who were told that the imitation food products are the wave of the future. Quote, you take the chemical compounds and you make the dish. End quote. Quote, so you have no vegetables, no fruit, no fish, nothing except compounds, and you have to create a shape, a color, a taste, a freshness, a pungency, an astringency, everything. And you no longer have to crack eggs He said this relegates real food ingredients to, quote, living in the Middle Ages, end quote. Okay. So, it's all about chemicals. It's all about molecules that are man-made. So, this is a person speaking about this. How about a person who is there also at the invitation of the chemical industry? A person who has clearly been vetted by the White House and the president. No one speaks at a forum like this unless they have been given a green light. So what does this tell us? It tells us that Monsanto and DuPont and other creators of genetically engineered organisms or completely artificial plasticized organisms are the wave of the future, and that's just one way of opening the door to all this. So I guess those of us who are eating natural and lots of fruits and vegetables and getting healthy, I guess we're, quote, back with the people of the Stone Age. All right. Well, to the pastry chef at the White House and to the president of the White House, why don't you take a moment and live in the real world where I live and sit across from a couple, she a former prosecutor from Texas, he a award-winning filmmaker this morning, and look at what happens when faced with a life-challenging illness that is now not a life-challenging illness and being able to start all over again. But was it chemotherapy or radiation? Was it one of these magic inventions of medicine that did it? No. And what will ensure these people a future free of disease? Those kind of middle-aged things that don't seem to be getting the credit for what they can do. The phytonutrients, the chlorophylls, the antioxidants, the very things our actual cells, the real cells in the body, need. Oh, and by the way, just kind of an aside here. Did anyone from Irish television ask to see any studies of how these completely artificial chemicals made to look and taste and feel in the mouth like food, what nutrients did they actually put into the cell? What antioxidant or AC factor did they have to protect the cell from free radical damage? Or is it a fact that all of these have never been shown to be a natural part of any cell and actually create pro-inflammatory cytokines, and therefore by eating these, irrespective of how they look and how they taste, actually cause the immune system to become hyper-vigilant and actually turn on itself? So we could have added a byline to this: eat future foods and die sooner. In fact, people in the Middle Ages would have lived longer than many of the people in the future when we have completely synthesized life. Sick from stress? Blame your mom and epigenetics, according to this scientific journal. Quote, if you're sick from stress, new research reporting out today suggests that what your mother ate or didn't eat may be part of the cause. The report shows that chlorine intake that is higher than what is generally recommended during pregnancy may improve how a child responds to stress. These improvements are the result of epigenetic changes that ultimately lead to lower cortisol levels. Epigenetic changes affect how a gene functions, even if the gene itself is not changed. Lowering cortisol, and I mentioned this yesterday, is important because elevated cortisols from any form of stress causes us to have heart disease, cancers, metabolic syndrome. So let me put it in real simple lay language. For all the mothers, when you eat really conscious, you eat healthy, you don't eat processed foods, chemical foods, salted and sugared foods, when you're eating wholesome grains, legumes, beans, nuts, seeds, fruits, vegetables, roots, and herbs, juicing, you're actually giving your child not just the good nutrients as it develops in the fetus, as the fetus develops, you're actually giving an energy, a a healing energy into the food itself, which will protect them later in life. That's called epigenetics. For those of you who have heard me talk about why cinnamon is so important, and I suggest cinnamon each day, especially those who are overweight or those who have prediabetes or diabetic conditions, here's the latest reasons for eating more real cinnamon. One, we know that cinnamon is important. We know that it has very powerful ORAC, or antioxidant properties. Aside from giving it the unique flavor, here's what it does. It lowers your blood sugar. Cinnamon can normalize elevated blood sugar, especially important for type 2 diabetes, and improves the ability to respond to insulin. It lowers cholesterol. Diabetics can also reduce their factors associated with cardiovascular disease by consuming even one daily gram, that's a third of a teaspoon of cinnamon. So that's good, and you can lower your cholesterol rather substantially. It supports a healthy blood clotting. Much research has been devoted to cinnamon's effect on blood platelets, which contribute to clotting. It helps thin the blood and prevent unwanted clumping of platelets that can lead to a stroke. So cinnamon each day helps keep a stroke away. It fights bacteria and fungus. Ayurvedic medicine has long used cinnamon for its antimicrobial qualities to support the immune system and prevent colds and flu. It also helps stop the growth of bacteria, fungus, and common yeast, candida. In fact, one study I've seen shows that it is an effective alternative to chemical food preservatives and has historically been used that, mainly the cinnamon oil and added to broths. Help reduce the growth and prevent the growth of foodborne pathogens for up to 60 days. And one of the most exciting things cinnamon and cinnamon oil does, it helps boost memory and protect your brain. So that's all important. I suggest the little tiny gels. 2 to 3 of those before a meal would be just terrific. So reduce inflammation, helps you with limit neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, even brain tumors and meningitis. And finally, it is one of the best single aids in digestion. In traditional Chinese medicine, cinnamon has been used for gas, nausea, and diarrhea. It helps you better digest fruit. So, real cinnamon, get the real cinnamon. The best is the Ceylon version, Ceylon. It's a little more expensive, and it'll be a lighter shade of brown with a little sweeter scent, but it's good. Now from our environmental segment, the drought that we're seeing now is the worst in 800 years. And yet, according to Science Daily, quote, as reported in Nature Geoscience, it will become the new norm. We're going to have dying forests, depleted river basins, depleted lakes, dried up water supplies, aquifers going dry, cities no longer to be able to be effective in supplying the needs of the people. And I'm not talking about 100 years from now. I'm talking about the next 10 years. So that's the latest. Just to let you know, there is a consequence to walking away from a problem, ignoring it for the decades, and then one day you wake up and it's on you. Now, you think genetically modified organisms are scary. They are. Nanotechnology is here in your store. Let me share something from Ann Gordon from Green Med Info. Quote, nanotechnology is measured in billionths of a meter, encompassing all aspects of life from food to medicine, clothing to space. Now, imagine hundreds of microcomputers on the width of a strand of hair programmed for specific tasks in your body. Engineering at a molecular level can now do that, and it's a corporation's great dream. Nanoparticles inside your body have few long-term studies, especially when linked to any health issue. Despite this new huge income-generating field, there is a growing body of toxicological information suggesting that nanotechnology, when consumed, can cause brain damage and therefore should undergo a full safety assessment. Now, why do I share this with you? Because right now, Congress, controlled by corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans, are taking away all of the protections that should be in place to make sure that everything that we consume is healthy and not be a part of a pro-industry, forget the consumer piece of legislation. That's what's happening. And right at the top of that list is nanotechnology. So they're going to be putting nanotechnology into everything that we consume. And I'm saying, let us not go there. Let's do the research first. Let them prove that it's safe in long-term studies before we start using it. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Now, I'm going to share two things. I'm going to share an extensive commentary on global warming, one that we need to hear from Bill McKibben, and then your feedback. Then we'll go to your calls, and then our guest, Dr. Seth Farber. We are also posting, someone just sent me this morning, this. Now, there is an accelerated campaign to try to, in any way possible, discredit my work right now, and it's been going on. That's fine. They have a right to do that. Of course, anyone who knows that all my work, I show the resource I use, I show my sources, I do the scholarship. They don't. They're being exposed. The public's attention is turning towards the truth and away from them, a lot of the public. Well, one of the groups that the orthodox or official medicine, big pharma, big agra, and the news media itself have used to discredit any alternative approach to healing, whether it's meditation or yoga, Ayurvedic or homeopathy, chiropractic especially, has been attacked by these people are the quackbusters. What the media refuses to tell you is that these quackbusters have been defeated in every court of law. They are bankrupt. But now what has come to my attention is something interesting. It's a 67-page report, and it is now up on our website today. And some people, of their own volition, took the positions I have taken publicly on the radio and in print, and they examined them against the attacks by Dr. Stephen Barrett and the Quackbusters. And they come up with some very interesting conclusions. The actual little piece is only about 5 pages long. The rest is, let me just read this. It says the following. The methodology. In order to determine who is accurate, Barrett or Null, we used only independent scientific peer-reviewed literature. Literally thousands of studies were examined. Conclusions. Quote, my review finds that Dr. Stephen Barrett's claims against Dr. Gary Null are unfounded, biased, personal attacks based upon his own personal opinion. Every article of Dr. Null's that I have examined has had a preponderance of credible scientific research to support the conclusions. Therefore, it is this journal's opinion that Dr. Gary Null is not only accurate in the substance of his articles and documentaries on topics such as the negative effects of fluoride, sugar, and mercury in dental fillings, but also that Dr. Barrett has engaged in unprofessional ad hominem attacks on Dr. Null without scientific support. At the end of this discussion, you will find samples in the peer-reviewed literature from each of the topics that serve as the basis of Barrett's attacks, demonstrating that Barrett simply does not have scientific proof for his arguments, but Gary Null does. And then it goes into, is Stephen Barrett credible? Why hasn't the New York Times published this? Because the New York Times has used Barrett. Why hasn't Consumer Report used this? But Consumer Report uses Barrett. Quote, the California State Supreme Court would answer this question with an emphatic, is Stephen Barrett credible? No. Stephen Barrett has presented his opinion and has staked personal credibility before the courts. On several occasions, in each instance, he has been made to suffer an embarrassing, unfavorable ruling. In 2003, the Quack Watch flagship, known as the National Council Against Health Fraud, brought suit against 43 alternative medical proponents in California, claiming that they were engaging in health fraud, quote, because they had been, what they were doing wasn't scientifically proven, end quote. The ruling, which arrived April 22, 2003, bludgeoned Stephen Barrett and the National Council Against Health Fraud and ripped apart their argument concerning what constitutes legitimate and effective health care. The court also declared that Stephen Barrett was, quote, was found to be biased and unworthy of credibility. Let me repeat that again. Listen carefully what I'm going to tell you from the actual Supreme Court of California. New York Times, I realize a couple of you over there may actually be interested in this. The rest of you wouldn't. Stephen Barrett, quote, has been found to be biased and unworthy of credibility. So the next time someone tells you, oh, I would listen to Gary Noll or watch his documentaries or read his articles, but I read on this quackwalk, but now you know. You say, hold on a second. Did you do your homework? Well, others have. Stephen Barrett, quote, was found to be biased and unworthy of credibility in court. That's not the only one. I have all these other references that I wasn't even aware of here in Barrett versus Rosenthal. The California Supreme Court voted unanimously to reject a libel claim filed by Barrett. His personal bias against alternative medicine was made unquestionably clear, as stated in the judge's ruling, quote, plaintiff Stephen Barrett and Terry Polovev are physicians primarily engaged in combating the promotion use of alternative or non-standard health practices and products. So then it goes into all the attacks. At the end of all this, 67 pages showing unequivocally, absolutely, we have science, we have the truth on our side. They don't. So enough of this. Now, to a commentary, then to a discussion that I think is extremely important, relevant for our times. Yesterday, Luann Panessi asked me my thoughts about the Olympics. And, of course, I have a great deal of respect for what an athlete has to do in committing their life and sacrificing the time and energy to be able to perform at that level of excellence. I separate that, and with my respect for that, for the other side of the equation, the gross commercialization of not just the Olympics, but all sports now in the United States. As a competing athlete today in my entire life, as a coach, having gotten 23,000 of my listeners in shape enough to do the New York City Marathon, I'm appalled at the athletic programs in many of the colleges in the United States, as is Chris Hedges. Fraternities, sororities, and football, along with other outsized athletic programs, according to Hedges, have decimated most major American universities. Remember when we went to school as baby boomers? Remember scholarship, inquiry, self-criticism, moral autonomy, and a search for artistic and esoteric forms of expression? In short, the world of ethics, creativity, and ideas. We had them at one time. Now they're shouted down by the drunken chants of fans in huge stadiums, the pathetic demands of rich alumni for national championships, and the elitism, racism, and rigid definition of gender roles of these immature Greek organizations, you know, the fraternities and sororities. These hyper-masculine systems perpetuate a culture of conformity and intolerance. They have inverted the traditional values of scholarship to turn 4 years of college into a mindless quest for collective euphoria and athletic dominance. There's probably no more inhospitable place to be an intellectual or a person of color or a member of a progressive community than on campuses of the Big Ten Conference colleges, although the poison of this bizarre American obsession has infected innumerable schools. These environments are distinctly corporate. To get ahead, one must get along. The student is implicitly told his or her self-worth and fulfillment are found in crowds, in mass emotions, rather than individual transcendence. Those who do not pay deference to the celebration of force, wealth, and power become freaks. It is a war on knowledge in the name of knowledge. Knowledge, as C. Wright Mills wrote in The Power Elite, is no longer widely felt as an ideal. It is seen as an instrument. In a society of power and wealth, knowledge is valued as an instrument of power and wealth, and also, of course, as an ornament in conversation. And that's unfortunate. hazing, comradeship, and complicity in sexual abuse, including rape, make up the glue that holds campus sports teams and fraternity houses together. The National Study of Student Hazing reports that 73% of U.S. fraternities and sororities haze. Since 1970, at least one student has died each year from hazing. 82% of these deaths have resulted from alcohol poisoning. Hazing weeds out those with enough self-esteem and independence to stand up to the hierarchy. It ensures conformity and obedience. These groups are, in essence, self-selected. Those who have the fortitude and courage to oppose their own public humiliation and the public humiliation perpetrated with each new cycle of recruits or pledges leaves. Those who remain conform. Athletic recurring parties that recruit, like fraternity parties at schools across the country, are plagued by gang rapes and sexual assaults. And these crimes, known by all in the fraternity or on the team, are met in locker rooms and Greek houses with a culture of silence, mocking the state admissions of the schools. Bernard Lefkowitz captured the sickness of this culture in his book, Our Guys. Lefkowitz wrote about a group of high school athletes in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, who in 1989 lured a 17-year-old developmentally disabled girl to a basement. The boy sexually abused her with a broomstick and a baseball bat. And when the assault became public, the town rallied. As at Penn State, not around the victim, but our guys. Athletic prowess was, as we saw to Penn State, glorified above human decency, compassion, respect, and the law. But this is true at most schools. As long as athletes perform, they are untouchable. The root of the problem is the culture of big-time athletics and Greek life. And it will not be addressed through NCAA sanctions or the removal of Joe Paterno's statue at Penn State. It will end only when fraternities, sororities, and football, along with other professional sport programs masquerading as college athletes, are banished from colleges and universities. These athletes, in the end, also are used. They are unpaid performers brought to the campus solely for their athletic prowess, who make millions for the school and their coaches. If you have a son or a daughter, especially a daughter, who wants to get an education, look for a school that has banished these organizations. The corporate world sees football players, fraternity brothers, and sorority sisters as prime recruits. They have been conditioned to join the team, to surrender moral autonomy, to accept and carry out acts of personal humiliation, to treat with contempt those who oppose them or who are different, to define their life by an infantile narcissism centered on greed and self-promotion, and to remain silent about crimes they witness or take part in. It is the very ethic of corporations. The ruling elite see in Greeks organizations, meaning the fraternities and football programs, the training ground for the amoral class of speculators, bankers, and corporatists who pillage the country. Hank Paulson, who as Secretary of the Treasury orchestrated a government payout of more than $12.9 billion to save AIG and Goldman Sachs, where he had been the chairman and chief executive officer, was a member of the fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon and an offensive lineman at Dartmouth. The billionaire hedge fund manager Stephen Mandel, who co-chairs Dartmouth's board of trustees, was, as Rolling Stone points out, a Psi Epsilon. Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, was a Phi Delta at Dartmouth, as were other trustees, including Morgan Stanley senior advisor R. Bradford Evans, billionaire Ormond Trevor Rees Jones, and venture capitalist William Hellman IV. And that is just Dartmouth College. Hazing is also integral to the military, where suicide, including the recent suicide of a Chinese-American soldier, Private Danny Chen, in Afghanistan, is often the result. It is almost impossible to escape your tormentors in the military. Suicide becomes, for many, the only exit. Chen, who was the sole Asian American in his unit, endured sandbags being tied to his arms by fellow soldiers. Rocks and water bottles were thrown at him. He was forced to speak Chinese instead of English, and he was taunted with the slurs gook, slant, chink, egg roll. Eight soldiers are being court-martialed in his death. A huge percentage of the suicides in the military happen because of hazing. Most of these cases are never investigated. The bodies are simply shipped home. In conclusion, corporate culture, which now dominates higher education, shares the predatory culture of the military. These cultures are about subsuming the self into the herd. They're about the acquiring of technical vocational skills to serve the system. And with the increasing budget cuts and more craven efforts of corporate donors, it'll only get worse. These forces of conformity are hostile to the humanities that teach students to question assumptions and structures, that prod them to seek a life of meaning and an ethical code that challenges the blind utilitarian obedience to power and profit that corporations and the military instill. We will, I fear, continue to turn out the intellectually stunted and maimed, those who know school football records, but no philosophy, no drama, no art, no music, no theology, no literature, no history. The goal of an education is not, in the end, to tell students what to think, but to teach them how to think. College and university administrators, defund libraries, close foreign language and classic departments, and invest staggering sums in gargantuan sports arenas and athletic programs. And the only time the student body protests or riots is when, as a Penn State, something unpleasant happens to their beloved coach. Pity the student who goes there to learn. The faculty administration will not help them. They are complicit or intimidated. Chris Hedges, I'm back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm going to hold off on my commentary on global warming's terrifying new math with Bill McKibben for tomorrow. I want to spend more time with my guest, a newsmaker guest today, Dr. Seth Farber, and your calls. I'm going to take your calls for Dr. Farber's comments and the commentary in a few moments. Our call-in number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And for all of the cab drivers listening right now on your radio or over a telephone, we welcome you. We have a lot of them out there. Dr. Seth Farber, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is a psychologist, but he is a dissident psychologist. And he has spent a great deal of his time as co-founder of the Network Against Coercive Psychiatry, which stands in the tradition of great revolutionary psychologists such as Thomas Saws, who we interviewed many times on this program. He's written several important books, his most recent being The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, and The Rise of the Mad Pride Movement, which, by the way, takes a fresh look at the failure of psychiatry to prove itself. Nice to have you with us again, Seth.
Thank you, Gary.
Seth, I'm going to ask you a series of short questions, then go into a little longer ones, all right?
Yes.
Is there any proof, scientifically, whatsoever, in any credible journal, peer-reviewed journal, that any part of psychiatry can be proven as a science?
No.
Okay. Is there any proof anywhere in the scientific literature that there is any such thing that can be proven as a brain chemical imbalance?
No.
Is there any proof that there is any real condition that can be proven associated with a dopamine-serotonin imbalance such as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, or manic depression?
No.
Is there any proof that 10 million children receiving antipsychotic medications each day, including Ritalin, are legitimate in the diagnosis or the treatment of those 10 million children being drugged each day?
Absolutely not.
Is there proof that the rash of suicides between 10 and 14-year-old boys, which is the number one cause of death in America, as well as many of the school shootings and mass homicides carried out over the last 20 years, are the result of people who were on antipsychotic or antidepressant medications?
Yes.
In the latest example, where the emphasis was solely upon, and unfortunately, even at this, and I say really unfortunately, because I wish someone would have called me, I would have debated the person they had on. It was all put on the ideologues who were saying ban guns. Nothing was reported on the medications taken, and yet I have a list that is 63 pages long of every major killing in schools, factories, offices, killing, suicide, or killing, and all those people on antipsychotic or antidepressant medications.
Yeah.
We have the date, who they killed, how many they killed, the medications they were on. Why is it, in your opinion, that even a so-called, well, I can't say that because we're on so many stations over the United States, but a non-commercial station in the New York area only looks at one part of the issue, the guns and weapons and access to them that they had, instead of the psychiatry, mental diagnosing, and pharmaceutical drugs to so-called treat these, when that is really where we should begin our discussion. You're now take us to a longer discussion.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. I think it requires some speculation, but it seems there's always been this intellectual hegemony of psychiatry over people who otherwise are often critical of aspects of the status quo, of the establishment of corporate America. You could see that on the left in like The Nation magazine and Democracy Now. Well, The Nation magazine is not even that critical of many things now that they're so tied in with the Democratic Party. But in general, the left has been reluctant to criticize the psychiatric establishment.
And Why?
Well,
just a few thoughts. The left has fully supported, without any challenge, the complete fraud of the medical industrial complex's treatment and diagnosing of HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
None of us deny the legitimacy of AIDS as a serious series of health conditions. What we challenge are the tests that they use, the drugs they use. The number one cause of death is from liver failure, which is the treatment is killing them. Yet no one in that left media will challenge it. They do not challenge the drugging of our children. They do not challenge the mass immunization programs. They do not, and I could go on.
Yeah.
And they have not once been out there to support us when we go against the genetic engineering.
Yeah.
So why do you think this is? Now, you're a psychologist. I'm asking you, as a human being who has a background in understanding human nature, what is the really big problem that progressives see in those who claim to be progressive but are just leftist?
You know, it's a mystery. I what came to mind was Elliot Wallenstein's book on lobotomies, which were not favored by many of course, the psychiatric profession was behind lobotomies, but many psychoanalysts were critical of it. But as Wallenstein said, with amazing unanimity, those who are critical of the procedure have failed to speak up publicly against it. So I had expected that all those people who would not review, forget about my books, take Kate Millett, who was certainly a celebrity in the 1970s and 80s, a kind of iconic figure on the left, and could not get her book, The Loony Bin Trip, reviewed in any of the journals. The Nation wouldn't review it. We had someone who had submitted a brilliant review, a young woman who had studied at one of the Ivy League schools, comparing The Loony Bin Trip to Dante. But at that time, Freudianism was as Thomas Oz once said, it's the religion of the Freudianism is the religion of the Jews. It actually was the religion of the intelligentsia in general. So I understood then why, because you know, so many leftists were psychoanalysts and were bewitched and fascinated and hypnotized by the idea of redemption through Freudianism. I at the time was a critic of it. In graduate school I was brainwashed and I believe in Freudianism. Okay, but so here now we are 20 years later and the whole field is, the psychoanalysts have been marginalized. They see only very rich people. Why are they not speaking out against the drug companies? That to me is a mystery.
Okay, all right, then let's go on from there. Some things are not in debate. What is not in debate is we're an overly medicated society. Would you agree with that?
That's right, certainly.
Okay, yeah. And one of the largest classes of drugs being given are the psychiatric drugs. Are you aware of how few protests there are against the pharmaceutical companies for profiteering, for fraudulent science, for having no efficacy or safety studies on their side at all? And when there is a question, I'm holding up right now today's New York Times, for those of you who are watching this. Here's today's New York Times, right?
Yeah.
Front page, caustic crusader at center of FDA scandal. This is from Eric Lightblow and Scott Shane. It says, as he often did, Dr. Robert Smith was hammering away at his bosses at the Food and Drug Administration in the most caustic of terms at a meeting to address his concerns about the approval of medical devices. With seven fellow scientists seated behind him in support, Dr. Smith charged that the managers of the FDA, quote, are not following the law, not following the science, not following the FDA core values, end quote, according to the notes of this session. He glared at a supervisor who sat fuming in front of him. Dr. Smith, a radiologist, a lawyer, a litigant, and a man now at the center of a spying scandal at the FDA. And it goes on. What this is about is the FDA was just caught.
Yeah.
Downloading illegally 80,000 emails. They had a hit list, an enemies list of 21 people, whistleblowers, scientists, physicians who were wanted to go public and tell the world, these drugs you're taking, these medical devices you're using,
yeah,
they're not safe. They're not effective.
Right.
They
wow.
were threatened. They were coerced. They were blackmailed. Everything you could do illegally against them was done.
Yeah.
But also they were tapping into legislator and Congress's emails. That's a felony.
Yeah.
They were listening in on the phone conversations or downloading the emails of the client and lawyer. That's a felony. And behind it all was the commissioner of the FDA. Why is it that why is it that this is not a major issue? Because you know what this does?
Yeah.
The New York Times is a very intellectually monotheistic institution.
Yeah.
It only has one way it can think.
Yeah.
Do you ever notice that? It is incapable of deep and profound comprehensive thinking. That's why it's
a gray lady.
Yeah. I would put it a little differently. I wouldn't call it a gray lady. That would be somewhat sexist and ageist.
Yeah.
I would say it is a schizophrenic, using the term absurdly.
Literally.
On the one hand, it says there's a problem at the FDA, and I have to ask, did you find the problem?
Yeah.
Did you go down there? We sent you a documentary, Death by Medicine. We sent you a book, Death by Medicine. We sent you Drugging of Our Children. We sent you Prescription for Disaster. We sent you 21 articles. Did you read any of them? Did you look at them? Why didn't you go down and break this story?
Yeah.
So you see, but what's worse, if they really opened this up and looked at it comprehensively, they would have to challenge every single medical procedure.
Yeah.
Synthetic hormone replacement therapy for women. Couldn't you see that on the front page? Every year, 10 million American women are put at risk of a heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, dementia, ovarian cancer, and colorectal cancer because of the worthless, dangerous drugs you're using.
Wow.
They would have to take on the drugging of our children. They would have to take on how we put people to sleep at night with their little butterfly pill or moth pills or whatever the hell that little cretin is. They would have to show that 90% of all medicine is a fraud.
Yeah.
Where do you go then? You're talking about a $3 trillion a year industry.
Yeah.
You're talking about all these medical groups.
Yeah.
Where do you go with that story?
Yeah.
Your thoughts, please.
I mean, it's It's a corporatization of all American life, and I think one of the reasons that it's the psychiatric profession has gotten away with it, and the medical profession, is that they're so often seen as a benevolent force. People put their full trust in them and are afraid to confront the facts that the emperor has no clothes. Thomas Szasz once said, it's not that the emperor has no clothes, it's that there's no emperor. So that basically all they are is costumery. There's nothing of substance there. And to recognize that these people that you put your trust in are really drug pushers and have no more morals or ethics or concern for children, like this guy Biederman, than the drug pusher on the street. People don't want to face that and look and deal with it. And even on the left, there's this, for example, you'll see so many of them saying, their response to Holmes is, oh, we need more mental health
That's
services.
Correct. That's the left promoting more mental institution, more drugging, more diagnosing.
Yeah.
My God, it has so betrayed everything that is authentic, and yet it prides itself in its own intellectualism. Well, get over yourself.
Yeah.
Your actions are stupid.
Yeah.
See, here's what it comes down to for me. Psychiatry is a fraud, complete and total fraud.
Yeah, I agree.
All right? The drugs they're giving us, therefore, are not beneficial. They're dangerous. They're causing suicide, homicides, the Columbine shooters.
Yeah.
All right? But what do? They bring right on Bowling for Columbine to promote the concept of gun control instead of, let's take a look at Eric Harris. What was he on? He was on Luvox.
Yeah.
We broke that story. Why can't we look for the truth? Are we afraid of it? Does our political idea and ideological reference point deny us the ability to see the truth?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that seems to be the case. Particularly, as I said, with psychiatry and an institution that... Well, you know, there's a selective ability of people to see the truth. For example, people on the left have no problem generally making a critique of the military-industrial complex or U.S. invasion over. On the other hand, if I've read, the same people who were out there protesting against Bush, rightly so, not only are not protesting Obama, this was in the Times, they think he's a dove. I mean, they're not even aware of that his policies are a continuation of George Bush's, and as you know, in many ways worse.
All right, Seth, here's a question as a psychologist. I'm asking you, can we any longer give anyone a pass on saying that we think Obama's a dove? When we see what he has done and the Congress has done with complete bipartisan approval by passing the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act, in effect making America a police state, whose responsibility is it then?
Yeah.
When you have all the proof in front of you every day, when you have the militarization of the police who will hit people, stun them, shoot them, shot into a crowd?
Yeah.
Why can't we have the President of the United States be equally outraged when innocent civilians are protesting an innocent guy, unarmed guy, being shot first in the leg, then shot in the back of the head when he went down on his knees and killed, people protesting that, and then the police came and you saw it on camera, releasing a attack dog on a woman with her child in her arms.
Oh, yeah.
And shooting a point-blank range. And where was the President say this is an outrage?
Yeah.
Why aren't we outraged when innocent people are shot, killed, profiled, when people are stopped and searched and frisked? I'd like to see this little punitive mayor stop, search, and frisk. I'd like to see someone pull down his pants, say, spread your cheeks, Mr. Mayor, even though you might be worth $23 billion, as you're any different than anyone else's.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you see, as long as you're rich and powerful, you don't have to ever act like a human being.
Yeah.
You're in a different league.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on this? When are we going to stop giving a pass to people for letting us believe that they're just stupid when they're not? They're complicit.
Yeah. Chris Hedges, I think you mentioned him, point out in relation to Obama, who's kind of a metaphor, a symbol for it. We thought, or at least some of us thought, there was going to be some substantive change in policies, but he knew, he realized before, and Ralph Nader and some other people, that we were just getting a different brand of the same thing. So I think that's a common technique in advertising. Change the packaging, change the brand name, and you sell the same product. It's the same poison, and you put it in different bottles. We see that with the marketing of the so-called atypical neuroleptics, which are no better than the, as Bob Whitaker and we've had on, are no better than the original neuroleptics. It's only when they come up and they want to market a new brand that we find out, that the average person will find out how bad Haldol was, how bad Thorazine was. For years, they said, this is the greatest, this is a miracle treatment. So when they come up with a new so-called antipsychotic, a new drug to use to suppress the population's creative abilities, because of the new marketing, they will then finally talk about how the older drug caused tardive dyskinesia and so on. And then they do phony studies to make it seem that the new drug is really much less, more benign than the old drug is. And the studies are phony.
Point well taken, and I appreciate that, Seth. Come back to the article done in 2005 in a peer-reviewed journal that showed that your typical antipsychotic was no better than a placebo, a sugar pill, but it had a 700% increase in suicide and suicidal ideation.
Wow.
So that was in 2005. Then why have all the prescriptions gone up since then?
Yeah.
What does that tell us about the public and the prescribers, the physicians?
Yeah.
What does it tell us about the media that knew about this? This was not a secret. This was well publicized.
Yeah.
So it's no different where I grew up in West Virginia, where everyone would sit around after dinner, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, have sugar, have a piece of cake, and then complain about their arthritis and diabetes.
Yeah.
At a certain point, we have to stop apologizing and making excuses for people choosing what they've done, even if we don't like the outcome or they don't like the outcome.
Yeah.
I don't believe that we are at all being responsible as a society. Individuals certainly are. For the bad choices we make, whether it's electing the wrong person to office or whether it's watching television that's going to adversely affect us, how we deal with people or desensitizing us to what's important in our lives. Seth, final comment from you. What do you see the role today being that could help us better understand that we are not a mentally ill society?
Frankly, Gary, I've given up on the trying to change the mental health system. I tried for not single-handedly, but with a group of the network, a group of activists in the Mental Patients Liberation Movement. I'm advocating just that people develop their own, for example, the Hearing Voices Network. I'm hoping it's going to spread here like it did in Europe. I mean, what the psychologist could and should do is spread doubt and about his own profession and about their ability to stand up to
and Seth,
standards of integrity.
Just remember, if you hear voices in the church or in the mosque or in the synagogue, you're praised for being close to God. Hear the same voices right outside on the street, and you're rushed off to Bellevue as a paranoid, delusional schizophrenic. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to be filming Seth. That's why I came by, and I just yanked him into the studio here. Seth Farber, author of The Spiritual Gift of Madness. Now, Luann Panessi just came in studio. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Wow. Boy, did I come in right in time. But I, as a nurse administrator, I remember I had hepatitis B, and I was nauseous, and they told me to take Thorazine. I had one Thorazine pill, and I was not someone that took medications. And you don't want to know what happened to me psychologically. First of all, I had no bearings at all as to where I was, what I was doing. I couldn't walk, and I suddenly didn't recognize my own parents. I mean, and that was just one dose of Thor. And we give Thorazine routinely for nausea when people, and Compazine when people are getting chemotherapy. It's frightening, but boy, you just hit the nail right on the head. Very quickly, I just read online today that India has a power outage. 600 million people affected by one of the world's biggest blackouts. Now, if anyone's been listening to you for about a year, almost a year ago today, you discussed that this kind of thing was going to happen, the population explosions, and how the governments are just not going to be able to keep up.
Let me address that. Before we go off our main stations, we'll continue on for another 5 minutes over the Internet, and people can listen over the telephone at 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. We have been lied to by all of the utility companies. We've been told not to worry about a solar storm, whether it's a 1X or 20X or 50X, because power goes down, they'll put it back. They're lying. They have no capacity if it goes down at a high level. I'm saying we already have an ancient power grid. And with the excessive heat occurring throughout the world, including in the United States, it causes more people to use more power for air conditioning, understandable. But then you're asking people who live in Arizona or live in states that have high temperatures to stay living there and continue 24/7 using power that eventually on an ancient grid is going to break. Now, this last year, one technician made a mistake on working with the power system and knocked the power out for 3 million people in Southern California about 8 hours. Here you have more people without power for 48 hours than the entire population of the United States. And why? It had nothing to do with solar storms or hurricanes, earthquakes. It had to do with too much usage. Now, they will have the ugliest house ever built on the planet. That's the most expensive house ever built on the planet. That looks like a parking lot with 7 stories up in Mumbai. And that they'll praise and they'll put money into corporatizing projects. They won't replace their grid. In the United States, we'll put money into corporate projects. We will not put money into repairing our infrastructure, our water mains, our sewer mains, our bridges, our dams, our levees, unless there's a Katrina. And it took a Katrina before they finally put money in that. And then that still won't hold a Category 5. Let me tell you today, I'll go on the record. If there's a Category 5 that hits New Orleans, you'll have thousands dead. That Mr. Big and Lake Punxsutawney and the levee will not withstand. That will wipe out people. So even when we do something, we do it wrong. So right now, we are one solar storm, a big one, away from seeing the same thing in India happen in the United States. But if it starts happening here and you get these rolling blackouts, how long do you think it's going to be before you start seeing people in inner cities, people who have no refrigeration, people who have no electricity, people who are in hospitals suddenly saying, what happened? Where's our tax dollars go? Oh, it goes to Afghanistan. It goes to the military-industrial complex. Oh, we have plenty of money to give $23 trillion in offshore profits because they don't want to pay a reasonable 10% profit to forgive all their other expenses. That would give us $2.3 to $3 trillion extra so we could afford all this. What would it cost to actually repair and renew our entire infrastructure, all roads, rail systems, bridges, tunnels? It would take about $800 billion maximum. That's how much is wasted each year in profiteering by the military-industrial complex. That's how much is taken by the insurance companies, for-profit insurance companies, and the for-profit hospital associations and the pharmaceutical companies as excess profit each year. So we have no shortages of places we could get the money to repair without taxing the American public. It's just that those in power make sure that whatever they have, they feel entitled to. So the next time a politician or wealthy person says, you need to work for a living, you're one of these spoiled brat, entitlement youngsters, say, excuse me, you're the most spoiled brat corporate youngster. You know, we may ask for a credit card to go to a mall to buy something made in China, and you're offshoring jobs to China by getting cheap money at zero interest and then building things you can reap enormous interest at. Who's paying for that? So at every level, we have to stop this insanity. Otherwise, what you saw in India will become the new norm. And only those who have private generators, the very wealthiest, will be able to not be inconvenienced. But remember, India is a very corrupt democracy, the largest democracy in the world. It's also the most corrupt in the world. It's not going to change. They don't care about their people. Only the wealthy get cared about. Just remember, AIG was bailed out, and then AIG bailed out Goldman Sachs. $12 billion they got on derivatives and credit default swaps. They didn't invest that money, but they got back what they didn't invest, and so they didn't lose. So everywhere you look, where we should put money in de-ghettoizing the suburbs and de-ghettoizing the inner city, we're not. When we look at what it means to be poor in America, we only look at the consequences of that small percentage that go to crime or go to gangs or go to vandalism. We do not look at what it would take to put a city right, a people right. Throwing money at a problem does not correct it. Addressing the inner needs of what it means to have understanding, counseling, humanistic input, and the resources to help a person be self-sufficient. And most people, that's all they want. We'll allow corporations, major banks, not only to be self-sufficient, but to have excesses to exploit. Those who really need assistance, we don't have a time or a dime for them. Shame on us, because the people we put in power are a reflection of our hubris. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Like a fish